It's 8 o'clock now, according to this machine. So I think most people are here. So let's start this morning's Dhamma talk. And for this morning's Dhamma talk, you may have noticed, those who have been on my retreats a few times, that the first couple of talks, on the first day or two, just more general talks. Yesterday I was talking about what happens when things disappear and vanish, and just how that uncovers what's underneath. But today I wanted to make it a little bit more formal, because often people ask about anapanasati, the mindfulness of the breath, and I thought I'd just discuss that for this morning's talk. Even though you may think you already know about anapanasati and what it is and how it works and where it leads to, nevertheless, it's always good just to reinforce some of these ideas, and even as you take it deeper. And first of all, whenever I talk about the word anapanasati, you know, ana means like along with, pana means the breath. But you may also notice that word pana from pana atipata veramani. Pana atipata veramani, so not to destroy living beings. And some of you may know, what actually is a living being? Does that also mean that you can't just wash mold off in the kitchen, or fungus? Do you have to leave that all there, and so everybody gets sick and dies? Otherwise you're killing this poor little living being called fungus or mold. And the limit is, according to the Buddha, that if it breathes, and that's called a living being, and something which breathes is called pana, pana atipata, killing something which breathes. And you may also know that this is not just Pali, the Indian language, this is also from English as well. What is a word for like beings? One of those words is animal. And if ever any of you here done Latin before? I know that Latin was a terrible thing to learn. Even I remember on the school desks where I learned Latin, someone had scribbled out this little poem and carved it into the desk. Latin is a language as dead could be. First it killed the Romans, and now it's killing me. But nevertheless, the word for breath in Latin is animalis. They have the same word, breath and being. It's very similar. So anapanasati means mindfulness along with the breath. And that's how it is pronounced. And sometimes I make this as a joke, but still it's serious. Anapanasati, mindfulness along with the breath. It's not pronounced anapanasati, which is mindfulness along with pain. But some people like doing that, but I don't know why. It doesn't really get you anywhere. So that's mindfulness along with the breath. And when if you go mindfulness with the breath, a lot of time all the pain and the tightness disappears. And there is the prerequisite, what you do first of all, and before you even get on to the first steps of anapanasati, mindfulness along with the breath. And the first step is to find a nice, quiet, comfortable place for yourself. And they have all these descriptions, which were very valid in the time of the Buddha in India, in places like forests or mountains or stuff. But these days, even in forests and mountains, sometimes you're not allowed to be in the forests or the mountains. You know, you're not allowed to be there because some are national forests and people don't know what you're doing there. And so because of that, sometimes we do need to find places which are calm and secluded, suitable for meditation. It's for that reason that we purchased and built this place here, Jhana Grove. Jhana is like the results of meditation, just deep peace and bliss. This is Grove, it's just a place in the forest. And that So that name was actually dedicated to this place by Ajahn Wayama. She suggested this name. Know that she's deceased now, but at least the name lives on, Jhana Grove. And of course, you know, I'm a jhana junkie, so I shouldn't say that, should I? But nevertheless, that's why as soon as she said that, yeah, I agree, before anyone else could complain, that was the name of this place. But to find a suitable place, and that's why we do put a lot of effort into trying to keep quiet, try and keep it comfortable here. And he says, once you find that quiet place, then sit down. It does say in the suttas, you know, legs crossed, back straight, you know, hands in front of you. But does that always work? Because some people, if I ask you all to take those chairs out, take the mats out, sit on the floor, then it will become not anapanasati, but anapanasati again. And it would not work. You see, that whole idea of finding a nice, quiet, comfortable place is there so that your body can relax enough so you can just get past it and go to things like the breathing. If the body is always harassing you, begging your attention, too hot, too cold, really cold, or, you know, too much noise, yes, you can meditate in such places, but it takes much more skill to be able to, you know, what I often say, create a little bubble around yourself. So the sound you cannot hear, it's like far away. Or the heat or the cold, you can't even feel or hear that either. You know, because you've managed to go inside and create a little, what the Buddha called the cave of the heart, Hadayang Guha, or Guha Hadayang. It's the heart going in a cave. That's what he said about meditation. Inside you can't hear much, from outside you can't feel much. You're deep inside, safe, comfortable and quiet. But until you have the skill to do that, you have to find a nice quiet place and sit comfortably, however that comfort is for you and however long it is comfortable for you. And then he starts giving the first instructions of establishing mindfulness. And they have this word, parimukkang. And it was wonderful to learn some Pali, which I did. And I learned Latin, so Pali is just, it's also a dead language, but doesn't kill anybody, not like Latin does. It actually enlightens people, because you see the Dhamma as the Buddha said it, and you get much more information. And that word parimukkang doesn't mean in front of you. What does that actually mean, in front of you? Where do you exist? A little, just to make this interesting, a little experiment here to involve you. Right now, just don't answer me in words, are you happy or are you miserable? If you are happy, please raise your right hand. Okay, keep your hand up. Now with that right hand, please point to that happiness for me. Where is it? And I love doing this. Because you're all pointing at different places. And some are going all over the place. Oh, I don't know. You were happy. You weren't imagining this. Why is it so hard to locate? It's because the happiness doesn't live in your body. It lives in your mind. Where is that located? It's not located in physical space. We'll talk about that in another talk later on. But nevertheless, you weren't imagining this. You were happy. So why is it that you are happy, but you don't know where you are? So how can you say that mindfulness in front of you should... Certainly, I don't live in front of my nose. I'm not behind my nose somewhere. So why do people think that mindfulness in front of you means watching your nose? And of course, this was an important reaffirmation for me, that when I was taught, first of all, to meditate at the tip of your nose, watch your breath go in and out there. which is fine if you don't have hay fever, which meant about 2 or 3 months of the year I couldn't watch the tip of my nose. It was all blocked up. So I thought, okay, 3 months of the year I can't do meditation. And then we got the idea from the Burmese monk, no, you can watch your abdomen go up and down, and your abdomen. I thought, wow, great. Now I can meditate 12 months of the year. But then the next problem was that when you're watching your abdomen, especially when you're keeping 8 precepts, you try watching your abdomen about 5 or 6 o'clock this evening. Oh, it's hungry. I was a young man when I started meditating. Of course you get hungry down here. So, none of that worked. And that was wonderful. Such a very lucky phenomenon. I had hunger down here in the evening as a monk and hay fever up here. So, I had to do it another way. And then when you looked at what the Buddha said, just watch your breathing. Where is your breath happening? Even if you've got hay fever, even if you're sick, you're still breathing somewhere. Just watch your breath, that's all. And I learned from that early time not to locate the breath. Then don't care where it was going in, where it's going out, as long as I knew it was going in, as long as I knew it was going out. And that's such a simple thing. So much so that, you know, when you teach kids, and kids have never meditated before in their life, I just, to start off with, and some of those kids I teach, maybe 50 or 60 years of age, it still works for them. I said, close your eyes, breathe in and out 3 times, and at the end of the 3rd breath, open your eyes. Simple thing. I never found anybody who cannot do that successfully. They breathe in and out 3 times, and then they open their eyes. And afterwards I say, well, how did you know? You did 3 in-breaths and 3 out-breaths. How did you know that? And they find it hard to describe, but it's something they do quite naturally. How they know the breath has gone in, gone out, it's up to them. So then I say, okay, close your eyes again. Now, breathe in and out 3,000 times. Just like you, they start laughing. Why? What's the difference between 3 breaths and 3,000 breaths? Just one's different attitude one has towards it. But anyway, so one starts with just learning how to observe the breath and then to establish that mindfulness, not in front of you. The word parimukkang has another meaning, and it is as a priority, number one in the list, the thing you put in front, the one which is the most important. And as soon as I saw that, I think, well, parimukkang in front of me, didn't that mention me anywhere? It just means the most important thing. So that's what you're doing, first of all. You're not trying to get enlightened. You're not trying to get rid of pain or sickness or whatever. You're not trying to get so powerful you can understand the lottery numbers. You are just trying to be aware. And of course, that also was so important to make that your first priority before you even start watching the breath. And when mindfulness becomes a priority, again, what is mindfulness? Many psychologists have got all sorts of different definitions of mindfulness. And some of those definitions are useful, some are crazy, but basically, what is mindfulness? It's being aware right now. Right now, first of all, you can't be aware of the past. You bend the past to suit yourself, as I said yesterday. As the future, how can you be aware of the future? It hasn't happened yet. You don't know. So it has to be in this moment. That's the only place where mindfulness can exist. Right now. And if you have a memory of the past, you're seeing it from here, from now. On the future, it's just, you know, if you're right here, right now, that's just a plan. A maybe, a fantasy. Probably won't happen. If you don't believe me, write down on a piece of paper every morning what you think is going to happen that day. And I bet you that your score is maybe 1 out of 10 at most, 0.5 out of 10. Because everything we think is going to happen never does. That's what I found in my life anyway. It's usually, if you think it's, because of that, I try not to plan. Because I realize when you plan something, well, first of all, people told me, you know, parents, teachers, friends, if you don't plan, things will go wrong. It's true. Many times when I don't plan, things go wrong. But when I do plan, they go wrong anyway. So it doesn't avoid things going wrong. All it does, it means it kills my happiness before they go wrong. So when I don't plan, it's going to go wrong. So if I do plan, it goes wrong. So I can just enjoy and be more relaxed. And it actually goes less wrong when you live in the moment and are more peaceful, more kind to this moment. So we learn how to be in this moment, first of all. The only place which has reality. Now. And in this moment, the next part of being mindful, in my definition, is being silent. When you're talking or thinking, you're not really aware of what you're experiencing. Silence, you're soaking up the information. Thinking is reacting to it, which means you're not really fully aware of what's happening right now. You're bending it. And this classic story which explains that so articulately, which many of you have heard hundreds of times, but whenever you hear me saying the same old story, please remember that I've heard it more times than anyone. That's logic. That was Lao Tzu taking one of his disciples for a walk in the mountains, had to keep the golden rule that you weren't allowed to speak. And they came to a ridge in the mountains, and there's a gorgeous sunset. And then the golds and the crimsons and the purples stretching across the blue sky. And it was such an amazing, unique sunset that the student couldn't help himself. He said, "Wow, what a beautiful sunset." He broke the rule. And the master turned around. Because the master had said, "You've broken the rule." The student said, "So have you." So anyway, the teacher turned around, went back to the monastery, and went back to the monastery, then scolded the student and said, "I will never allow you to go on a walk with me ever again." It's a bit harsh. So the other, his friend, said, "Well, what's wrong with just saying what a beautiful sunset? What's wrong with that?" And that's where Lao Tzu just gave the beautiful answer. When the student said, "What a beautiful sunset," he was not watching the sunset anymore. He was only watching the words. He wasn't mindful. He's mindful of words, of thoughts. Thinking, "What a beautiful sunset," is very different than just seeing the beautiful sunset. If you understand that, you understand the importance of silence. And how real mindfulness is silent, present moment awareness. And I must say, I'm going to thank the person who encouraged me to explain like that was, you know, my former boss, Ajahn Chacko. Because, you know, he heard me teaching meditation, said, "You know, you're really good at teaching those high stages of meditation. What about the basics of meditation? Spend more time sort of instructing on that, so that when people, they can get close enough, so all those other teachings about nimittas and jhanas, they can really appreciate." And that's one of the reasons why I spent much more time on simple things like present moment awareness and silence. Because once you are quiet inside, in this moment, it's so much easier to relax your body and relax your mind. And that's why just So often, if I've got an ache or a pain somewhere in the body, I just feel it. That's my knees now. You don't do anything. When I say, how's my knees, that's not what I say. I just get drawn over there if it's aching or not in the right position. And then you're just there in silence. In the silence, you learn. I've often told this to students at school. The easy way of learning at school is to be silent when the teacher talks. I don't mean just with words, I mean with your mind. And when your mind is really quiet and you're listening to the teacher, it's amazing how much you soak in. And that's one of the reasons, and I came from a poor family, really did. You know, many people are proud of how poor they were. But, you know, my family were extremely poor. But when I went to school, in primary school, I didn't understand at that time why in my primary school there were so many people from so many different nationalities. It was because it was migrants would come to that poor area of London. And so the school was poor. But I always did really well. And, you know, sometimes from there I went to a really big high school, which was, you know, quite hard to get into, on scholarships all the way. And then to Cambridge, for goodness sake. How on earth did that happen? And it was, I think, because I had a natural mindfulness. Obviously, you know, you can understand where I learned that mindfulness. And natural mindfulness, so when the teacher was speaking, I would listen. 100%. So much so that it would soak in very easily. And sometimes some questions would be asked, and I knew the answer immediately. Just your brain are trained to be mindful. So that's why I did well at school, easily, without having to work hard. So little by little, you realize just how mindfulness can create so much happiness, learning, appreciation. And you can see a sunset, or like see the stars at night, or see the full moon. Full moon's up this evening. And I don't know, there's something about that full moon. You don't try and explain it. You just know it, see it, and enjoy it. You practice mindfulness of the full moon. Maybe I shouldn't say this, but I'm going to say it now. After the talk this evening, or even early in the morning, if the sky is still clear, go and sit on the stone surrounds of the stupas out there. Lay on your back and just stare at the stars. Don't think of anything. Don't try and figure out what these stars mean. Just lay on there and just let the incredible beauty of the full moon and the stars just soak into you. When people are asking you afterwards what you were doing, you were strengthening your mindfulness. Being aware in this moment. If you start to think, conceptualize, plan, or whatever, then stop it. It's a waste of time, a waste of space there. But if you're quiet and silent, you can watch those stars and it's blissful in the silence. So anyway, that becomes what the mindfulness, establish that mindfulness first of all. How do you know you've established mindfulness? It is because your body starts to become aware. Even what you eat, all this food which people cook for you, you put a spoon in your mouth. And it's incredible, the taste which you can experience. Often on these retreats, people say, thank you to the cooks, the food here is amazing. But if you ate that food in their house, when people are talking all the time, it will not taste half as delightful. It's because when you're mindful, you're able to pick up so much of not just even the tastes, but the care and love which people have put into that food. Sometimes it blows my mind that people have come all the way from Perth, and they've been up early this morning cooking your food for you today. And they come and they offer it for free. And all they want is just to see you happy, having a lovely meal, so you don't have to worry yourself about eating, and you can have a nice afternoon, evening, meditating. The care which they put into this is fantastic. And it's for you. When you start contemplating that, wow, that gets you all sort of really inspired. If you got some food from a restaurant, if they had delivery, I'm not sure if anyone's tried this yet, whether you can give a call to the pizza delivery in the evening, but most people are in bed by 10 o'clock. Can you come to the Jhana Grove Retreat Centre gate and get a pizza? If you tried that, it will not taste nice at all, because it's where it comes from. So after a while, then you know that your mindfulness is going really strong. When you start to, as I said in the first day, to see a world and a grain of sand, a heaven and a wildflower, hold infinity in the palm of your hand, and eternity in an hour. It's spiritual, it's not a plaything. And after a while, when you get into that present moment, you really make it strong. You don't want to worry about the past or the future. It's just so gross. Compared to, what was it? I remember years ago when I went over to UK and I was looking after one of the senior monks over there, being the what they call the upatak, the attendant. They went to visit in somebody's house. And they put us in a little room for a little while. But I can see through two doors, someone had a TV on. That was the first time I'd seen a TV in 9 years. We didn't have televisions in monasteries. And I couldn't believe it was just so harsh on my eyes. The colours were changing so quickly, and there was just so intense colours. Not like ordinary colours. The colours over here is as browns and as yellows, but they're not sort of harsh. They're soft colours, the colours of nature. And the amount of the frames were changing so fast and so fast, it was like giving me a headache. It was only about 10 or 15 minutes. I just looked in there to see what it's going to happen. Never ever wanted to see that again. You get used to that now, though. If it's not changing fast enough, it's boring. Oh, I can still remember the violent TV shows I saw as a kid. Oh, just anyone as old as me, Dixon of Dock Green. It's a police show. There was no violence. Just if somebody got out a gun, the police officer would say, "Hand it over, son, don't do anything stupid." "Oh, yes, okay." And he'd hand over the gun. And he'd say, the criminal would say, "It's an honour to be arrested by such a famous policeman as you, Sergeant Dixon." It's actually crazy. But anyhow, that the mindfulness gives you a sense of softness and peace and beauty, which is wonderful. That's one of the reasons why we do it. So we build up that mindfulness. And then, when you want to watch your breathing, so it's simple to do. You sit down, close your eyes, and just watch your breath. But it says in the suttas that when you're breathing in a short breath, you should know it's a short breath. When you're breathing out a short breath, you should know it's a short breath. When you're breathing in a long breath, you should know it's a long breath. When you're breathing out a long breath, you should know it's a long breath. I don't know if you're rebellious like I am. But I said, well, what happens if you're breathing in a middle breath? That's not mentioned, is it? It's only short and long breaths. And how short is short? Well, actually, it's a long breath. How long? Well, if it's a super long breath, does that still count? You're still doing anapanasati? After a while of challenging, you know, ideas like that, you realize you don't have to watch a short breath first and then a long breath, or even if it's not short, it's not long. All that it's doing It's giving you a little bit of extra interest in watching your breath. Instead of just watching a breath, yeah, now what? Is that a long breath, a short breath, or in between? Is it really super long or very, very short? What actually is it? It makes it more interesting for you to watch. The same as a walking meditation. When you're actually moving your legs, when you start walking meditation, the first step, how do you walk? You're doing it for such a long time, you take it for granted. When your foot moves, does it move straight up? Does it go horizontal and then down? And after a while you find, well, I don't know, my feet, when I sort of move, it moves up and then back a bit. And then it just goes on like a curve forward and it goes down. What part of your foot touches the ground first? Your heel, your toes? What touches it last? All you're doing is those little questions there. It just makes you more aware. There's more to see there. So just pointing out, have a look over here, have a look over there. It gets really, really interesting. Is your in-breath longer than your out-breath? Or the other way around? The gap between the breaths, between the when the in-breath stops and then the out-breath begins, or the gap between the out-breath and the in-breath, which is longer? Now, those are not really necessary. If you don't answer those questions, it doesn't mean you're not going to get enlightened. It just makes it a little bit more interesting so that when you start watching the breath, it consumes more of your attention. Other times, people, they use mantras. These are little tricks which people use to watch the breath with. And, of course, in the Thai forest tradition, it always used to be buddho. Breathing in, bud, breathing out, to. Buddho. Good. Now, if you are in that part of the world, or if you are, I don't know, even with Sri Lankans, you've grown up with Buddhism, or no, Indians who are Buddhists. If you've grown up with that, you know, even the word has got power. And so that makes it very important to watch. But for sometimes, if you haven't got that real deep feeling for that, the meaning of that word Buddha, it doesn't really affect you. It doesn't usually work. And after a while, the mind wanders off as usual. That's why I like just getting more the feeling of it. And of course, you know what I did when I first came here, you experiment. You ask people to watch their breath with buddho, buddho, buddho. They just didn't work. It's because they didn't have a feeling for it. So knowing the major problem is people keep thinking too much, we change the word buddho to, as you breathe in, you say shut. Breathe out, up. Shut. I did that. And that's what you did. They just laughed. That was funny. I was being serious at first. But anyway, so if you are going to use a mantra with the breath, one of the ones which I found most helpful was breathing in something positive, like breathing in peace. However you imagine peace, or if you're really sick, breathing in health. If you're really tired, constantly tired, breathing in energy. But don't just say the word. What does that word say energy mean for you? And imagine it, even if you can visualize it, paint a picture of it, and then imagine that coming into you. Like peace. I don't know, some of the symbols of peace, like a dove. Imagine it just flying into you, the dove of peace coming into you. Whatever peace means to you. Because when you visualize it, when you make it much more than a word, but what that word is pointing to, it has more power. You do that a few times, and then you feel like peace coming in. And after a while, when you know exactly what that peace is and what you're trying to let go of, then you don't need to say the words anymore. You just know the feeling, what it's represented. And just allow that to come into your body. And then sort of what you don't want to let go of. Little by little you find that that actually works. Especially if people just do have things like cancers and other sort of long-standing illnesses. You know, you can breathe in sort of purity or something. Breathe out tumour. Breathe out peace, be that. It works. But anyway, that gets you in touch with the breath. You start to feel it. In breath, out breath, long or short. As long as you know the breath. And then you know the whole breath. I know that this is the first time there is some controversy. Because the Buddha actually, the way it was worded, as the body, the kaya. But the body means like a body of troops, a body of evidence, a body of so many things. And he actually explained it afterwards very clearly. It means the breath. Feel the whole breath. That means, not just, I'll just use a simile here, just watch my finger. That's it's my right, your left to right, going in, out, in, out. That's just watching the breath. The whole body of the breath, you see it from the very beginning as it starts to go in, right to the end. You see it pause. The out breath, from the beginning, right to the end. That's the whole of the breath. It happens naturally anyway. A lot of the time when you're watching the breath and the mindfulness increases, it becomes more interesting. It demands all your attention. You're becoming so calm, you're just watching the breath go in. Right to the end and then go out. You don't force it. You're watching, it's nice to watch. Just like when you're walking meditation. You can feel just the whole leg come up. Just go forward and then go down. It's not left, right, left, right. It's just the whole of the movement of one leg as it goes down. It's fascinating to watch that. And it doesn't get boring. That was a surprising thing when I first heard this. I'm watching your breath for an hour. How boring. Get a life. There's many interesting things to do in life. You're just watching your breath. You go in there and do what you're doing. You're just watching yourself move. You're watching your feet go up and go down. Crikey. But the truth of the matter is you know, you probably experience, oh, it's amazing. It's so beautiful, so delightful. And it's free, easy, relaxing, no bad side effects. And it's a wonderful thing to do. You enjoy it so much. Because the joy is not sort of taking you away into fantasies and entertainment and stimulation. It's calming you down and still keeping your awareness really strong. And that awareness, when it gets strong and peaceful, it's like all this energy which you wasted is now conserved. And the energy builds up peaceful energy. More like drinking too much coffee energy. You're all over the place. This is focused energy. It's really still but beautiful and strong. And anyway, then you get to just knowing the whole breath and then calming it down. Sometimes calming it down, is that what you're supposed to do? All these stages, you know, oh, I've done this one now, now I can do the next one. Have I finished stage two? There's 16 stages of Anapanasati. Oh, crikey, right? Have I completed one? Ajahn Pam, can you please tick off? Yes, I've done number one. So now I can do number two and number three. People actually ask me that. That's not what Buddha's meditation is all about. Because, you know, you just allow it to happen. These are landmarks which you observe on the journey into deep stillness. They're not things you aspire for. Just what happens when you're not aspiring for anything. You're relaxing. So your breath calms down. It's really peaceful. Obviously, because you're not metabolizing that much. You know, you're not sort of doing very much, so the breath is not necessary. It's just like a car just purring just in the garage because it doesn't have to do anything or go anywhere. When it does that, it's so peaceful, so beautiful, so nice. That was one of the reasons I mentioned the story about the mosquitoes the other day. And those mozzies, I thought, when you get into deep meditation, I thought that was the power of deep meditation. It was some sort of force field around you, you know, which other people couldn't see, but the mosquitoes couldn't penetrate. You could imagine them trying to get through your force field, but they couldn't do that. Unfortunately, that's not what was happening. It's just ordinary science. That once your metabolism is going down, you're not worried, you're certainly peaceful. The breath is just so soft. That is when you're not emitting so much carbon dioxide. And that was what attracted the mosquitoes. The more you worried, the more you were concerned, the more those mosquitoes would come and bite you. You're saying, here I am, mozzies, come on. But when you were quiet and peaceful, they couldn't find you. Because the metabolism went down. So anyway, there was a sign that your breath was getting very soft, very peaceful. At this time, sometimes people lose awareness of their breath and lose awareness of everything and they just don't know where they are. This is a common problem I've heard, and the answer is very simple. As you are developing, you know, the peaceful breathing, please, joy will come up. It will look nice. There will be pleasure. There will be delight there. It's one of the reasons those who have listened to me do guided meditations in Nolamara, you know, even with the body relaxing, it feels delightful. And I just focus on that delight, and the body relaxes even more. It's there every time. And I always manage to find it, enjoy it, because what I'm doing, I'm allowing my mind to enjoy the meditation. Simple. When I can notice that delight, then when you get still, you're watching the breathing, and it gets very quiet, and it is delightful. Beautiful delight. More delightful than the body being quiet. And you can feel it with your emotions. It is, as the Buddha said, a citta sankhara. It's not with the body, it's with your mind. It's how the mind looks at things. And that is why you can look at anything. I'm sure I'll tell that story later on, but I won't tell it now because I'm already losing a bit of time. Is even the most unlikely things appear gorgeous and beautiful, really delightful. I won't tell that story. I'll tell another similar story. One of the first times this happened to me, over in Thai, walking meditation, the concrete floor in the walking meditation, oh, it's actually in the main hall, you know, during the rains retreat, it was almost impossible to walk outside because there was rain was pouring down and the grounds were flooded, so we'd walk inside our main hall. And as you were walking, just watching your feet moving and going down, and you always put your gaze about a body length in front of you, not left, not right, just in front of you with your eyes open. I had to stop. The reason I stopped was a piece of concrete in front of me was like absolutely beautiful. It was gorgeous. It was like some work of art. Like, you know, painted by some modern artist who really knew what they were doing. Because it wasn't very smooth concrete. It was done by the villagers. So it had lots of bumps. It had contours. It had texture in it. Not just the texture, but the different shades of, you know, the light grey, the darker grey, the in-between greys of the concrete floor. And just looking at it, and just how all those different shades are melded together, and just how the contours just reinforce the beauty of that piece of concrete. And I think it's because monks knew what happens in meditation, they didn't send me to the funny farm. I didn't think I was crazy, because I was just sitting there, just wowing at this piece of concrete and thinking it should be cut out and sent to the Tate Gallery in London as a beautiful work of art. Was I going crazy? No, this is just what happens when you meditate. When the mind starts to get strong, you can see beauty in so many different things you've never seen before. When that happens, that's where you realize the mindfulness is getting strong. When piti, sukha, the joy and happiness start to arise. You can see that with a piece of concrete, how easy it is to see on your breathing. Breathing in. That's so nice. I did mention to some monks and nuns, I think a few days ago, there was Ajahn Chah's basic teaching. Sorry, no, Ajahn Gunha, he's still alive. Ajahn Gunha's teaching. When he came and spent a rains retreat here years and years ago. Whenever we would ask him to please, can you teach some meditation? Because you know, he's a great meditator. All he'd ever say is just breathing in, sabai. Breathe out, sabai. That's it. And sabai meant nice and easy, beautiful. It meant just with the piti sukha coming up, the joy and happiness, breathing in. Oh, that's delightful. And sometimes we'd ask him to elaborate, and he'd say, okay, breathe in the most delightful breath you could possibly breathe in, ever. Oh, and then breathe out a beautiful, delightful, wonderful breath. Really get into it. Don't be afraid of the delight. And carry on. It wasn't much of a teaching, but it was very profound. He's one of the first ones who's encouraging you to, when that delight comes up, welcome it and enjoy it. Then, do you lose your awareness? No way. Having the time of your life. You're enjoying it. That's exactly what the Buddha told you to do in the 5th, 6th, 7th and 8th stages of Anapanasati. Breathing in and out, experiencing piti, joy, breathing in and out, experiencing happiness, breathing in and out, experiencing the citta sankhara, and then calming that citta sankhara. It just happens naturally. And then what happens? When you get the happiness coming up, it's easy to meditate. You're enjoying yourself, having a wonderful time. You don't get dull. You just, when the bell goes, do we have to get up? And the answer is no. You carry on meditating. Don't worry about lunch. How many lunches have you had in your life? How many jhanas have you had in your life? So it's really a non-contest. They just enjoy it. And afterwards, some people say, well, why did you miss lunch? So just having too much fun. And imagine out there in the world when you actually say that and you do that and it's obvious that's what's happening. What on earth is going on with this meditation? You mean you'd rather be hungry in the afternoon than have a nice, beautiful meditation? So yeah, obvious. And now your meditation is getting somewhere. You know, sometimes I always used to think that if I meditate for too long, my knees would ache, my back would ache, I'd have a sore bum, and everything would ache. It's a weird thing. You try this out for yourself. The longer you meditate, the less it hurts. Weird. You meditate for an hour and you're stiff, at my age. If you meditate for 3 or 4 hours, not stiffness in the body at all. Somehow or other, in those deep meditations, it's great for your body. Everything just softens and eases, and afterwards, there's no aches or pains at all. That was weird. I remember this one place which I went to. Then again, the 6th rains retreat. And traveling all day from one monastery to another. And in these small, we couldn't really call them buses. You know, they were small. And usually in a place where you'd have maybe room for 2 people to sit, there was 3 people assigned in that seat. So you were squashed against the wall with the chickens and all the other stuff, which is a village bus. You know, you've seen those buses before, and it was all day in that bus, and finally got to our destination about 5:30, I think. And when I checked in with the senior monk, they said, oh, you're just in time. Because at 6 o'clock, every evening, we do a 4-hour meditation. Mm-hmm. I've been travelling all day. Didn't even have time for a shower. Just quick, put some water on your face, glass of water, and then go and sit. But this is going to hurt. Travelling all day, no preparation, 4 hours. But it was good because you had to, you had no choice. So I sat there and I realised you can't mess around, because otherwise it's going to really hurt terribly. So I got myself nice and comfortable and did my meditation. And then when they eventually rang the bell, I complained. It was 1/4 hour earlier. It was only 3 hours and 45 minutes. It took away 15 minutes of my bliss. What did you do that for? I was really enjoying it. You get into deep meditation. In that deep meditation, you don't have any aches and pains in your body at all. And afterwards, it's just really nice. That's weird. I don't know how it works. You see, the longer you sit, the more tense you should be. But something happens in meditation. Everything just loosens up and just whatever needs to flows here and flows there. You don't know what's going on with your body. You can't feel it at all. You're in your mind. You're not sort of sleeping at all. You're perfectly alert in this moment. Quiet. And it's gorgeous. That's what happens with the pity and sukha. Once that pity and sukha gets very strong, then very often what happens? You see what we call the nimitta. This is that ninth stage of anapanasati, become aware of the jitta. What is a jitta? The mind, the sixth sense. That is when the other five senses have disappeared. You can't feel sort of the body anymore. You can't hear sounds. You have to be a very loud sound to be able to, or a very kind sound to get you out. And then all you do is got this beautiful, usually light in your mind. And after a while, that's, you know, the nimitta experiences. And that's actually how the Buddha taught. It's not just in the commentaries. There's a whole sutta called the Upakalesa Sutta, taught by the Buddha about the problems with nimitta and how to overcome those problems. And those are problems to overcome. But the biggest ones is always fear and excitement. You got beautiful nimitta. Yes, I'm getting close. And you've already blown it. Don't get excited. Don't get afraid. Fear also comes up. Oh, it was a bit much for me. I've got to go back to work when this retreat is over. You don't get afraid. It's all beautiful stuff. But no, that's the reason, most reason we get afraid, because we can't control it. It takes that more degree of letting go. You're out of control. You always were out of control. You thought you were in control, but you can't be, and just let it happen. It's gorgeous. And then the nimitta comes. We're around now, the 10th, 11th stages. It's actually abhipramojjhana. Abhipramojjhana means a couple of things it means. It means like getting confidence in it. Leave it alone, it's growing. Get it even more powerful, more joyful. Sometimes I call it shining up the nimitta. And after a while, that nimitta gets gorgeous. And you can't shine it up enough. That's why a few times, I've already started on this train of explanation now, so I'm going to carry on. Sometimes people might get desire when I start talking like this, but sometimes the pleasure you get in just a nimitta, sometimes you feel a human being can't take so much pleasure. You interested? And if I know you, you can. You can take more. Nothing goes wrong. And even this guy who came, we get all sorts of people come to monasteries. This guy came once and he was a heroin addict. And he was trying to kick the habit. And I just, you know, you could see that he was a really good guy, but sometimes he said, you just take heroin once and it just grabs you and won't let you go, ever. And he said many times he tried to kick the habit. He had a beautiful wife and he was just staying with him, making sure that he was giving him maximum encouragement. And he was doing really, really well. 8 or 9 days he stayed at this monastery over the road. But then he said, he described it so beautifully. An addiction like that, you have to say no so 100 times every hour. You only have to say yes once, and you're back on the heroin. And after about 9, 10, 11 days of being clean, he said yes once. And he was back on it again. It's a terrible, terrible thing. But one thing, the reason I tell the story is, you know, I was going off to go into Nolamara thing. He came running after me. He said, Ajahn Brahm, before you go. I said, what? He said, I did get a nice meditation. And I have to tell you this. I know you've never taken heroin in your life, and that's true. And he said, but I know, you know, you had girlfriends before. And you keep on saying, Ajahn Brahm, this is the only thing which I can describe. So, you know, when I was a student, the bliss of the deep meditations is much better than sexual orgasm. People criticize me for that. Please don't criticize me. I'm just explaining just what it's like. And then he said, I kind of sort of understood that. But then I, you know, had a nice deep meditation. And I'm saying something which I never thought I'd ever say. He said that it's even better than the bliss of a heroin kick. I never thought anything was as gorgeous as heroin, but this was much more so. That's the sort of pleasures we're getting into. And that is the sort of delight which is available for you and which you shouldn't be afraid of. You even welcome it. And I say that purposely, because what that does, that it can overcome some of the fear you have. So when it starts to happen, you let it happen. It really happens. You really let it happen. And soon you get very, very still and blissed out. And those become the jhanas, which I'll talk about another time. But those are just having confidence, brightening up that nimitta. Samadhang nimitta. Even like, when they say concentrate on the nimitta, you've got no choice. The most beautiful thing in the whole world you've ever seen. Of course you're going to look at it. You can't take your eyes off it. You don't force it at all. You still everything. Everything becomes very quiet and very still. It's totally satisfied. And then, of course, then it goes into the 12th stage, Vimocha Yang Chitang. And if you know your Pali, that's the word that means freeing the mind. That means entering the jhanas. And you've got the eight freedoms, vimokas. That's what it's pointing to. So anyway, that's how we meditate. Have a lot of fun. A lot of joy. Totally safe. Okay, I should actually say, because somebody will probably bring it up afterwards, there is one danger. There is one and only danger in getting into the deep meditations. Many people who get those deep meditations tend to lose all their hair. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. That's Anapanasati. Hope you enjoyed that. That was interesting just how it went. Start off with ordinary things, just finding a nice root of a tree and stuff, and you go all the way up to the nimittas. Why not? Okay, have a nice meditation today. And later on, there's interviews. Please keep the interviews to 10 minutes each, because otherwise I get into trouble.